Magazine, a KKFI public affairs program of progressive activism, opinion, and commentary. Opinions expressed on this program are those of the speakers alone and are not necessarily the views of KKFI, its staff, volunteers, board of directors, show hosts, or other guests on the program.
Okay, this is Craig Lubow, and thank you for joining us here on Radioactive Magazine. Today we're going to be talking about homelessness issue. This is in addition to what is going to be tomorrow, as you all, if you've been following our website or our promos. Tomorrow is the National Homeless Marathon, and this is not related to it. It's coincidence that we're covering that today. And my guest is Brandon Furtig. Brandon is a blogger, writes, and also just recently released independent film, which is, I think, his first film, relating to homelessness at a camp that he's been following and keeping in touch with people up in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Welcome, Brandon.
Hello, Craig. Good to be on your show. It's a privilege. Thank you.
Okay. So the movie you made is called The Wall, and it's about a homeless camp. It's referred to as The Wall up in Minneapolis. What made you, first of all, what got you involved in wanting to cover the homeless issue, and what made, prompted you to make the movie?
Well, I was interested in homelessness, especially following a trip to the Pacific Northwest in the summer of 2017. I traveled out there for a video series on people of the Pacific Northwest that would just feature idiosyncratic individuals, marijuana farmers, people living along the coast, people in the cities, of course, and it would involve a few homeless people, actually, that I didn't anticipate, but ended up being a few of my interview subjects, both in Seattle and in Vancouver. And the lifestyle and the human interest side of it was interesting, but then also sort of the analytical side of it, like why is this problem growing, and is there anything that can be done about it? So, and you know, it had been talked about for years and years, but a lot of the coverage I saw of it was, it didn't go very in-depth. That I could find, at least lately, when I looked up newspaper articles or just followed stories since that trip. And a lot of the same causes were repeated. So I thought, well, I'm going to do a work on this issue, a documentary on this issue. And I returned home where I live in Minneapolis. And then about a year later, we had a homeless camp of our own, sort of bring up out of nowhere. The city granted a few individuals permission.
Brandon, I do need to interrupt you for just 1 second to point out for the people who just joined us that we are, this is Radioactive Magazine, and you're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. All right, go ahead,
all
Brandon.
Right. Sure. So it would have been the summer of 2018 now, and Minneapolis had its first major tent city in recent memory, and this would become a large one, I think, by most city standards. It would grow up to be about 300 people, 150 or more tents, and it really grew because the city gave this camp its blessing, whereas before it would shut down camps before they got too large. And the permission of a camp sort of consolidated many of the area homeless, and in particular, the area Native American homeless. So that whole community came together in that one location, which was against the sound wall along a freeway. and that's why it was called The Wall, and that's why I called the film The Wall. And so I thought, well, obviously this is an easy, this is right here in my backyard, so to speak. So I started to visit it and interview the individuals there about their lives, what brought them there, what life was like in a homeless camp, and then what their hopes are following their time there. And at some point I thought, you know, I don't need to do a whole story on homelessness in the U.S. It's too big, and this is a story right here. This is a movie of its own. So I would end up focusing on that, this particular tent city here in Minneapolis. And I completed the film. I completed the recording, most of it, last winter when the camp was shut down last December, which would have, December of 2018. And then I just began editing and getting a soundtrack and putting the film together throughout the winter and spring. And then in May, this past May, I had a premiere in Minneapolis, and then two more screenings following because the premiere sold out. So it was received fairly well. People were just very interested in the topic because it was fresh, and we had never seen a tent city like this in our city. And so there was a lot of interest both during the camp to help the people there with donations, and then following the camp, just to find out how the people are doing and just sort of, to just sort of look back on this story from a broader lens of the entire year. So, you know, the news would cover it day to day to week to week, but my movie covers the story of the camp itself in addition to the individuals who live there, you know, over the course of several months, pretty much stretching the whole fall and winter into the winter of 2018.
And did you visit that tent camp like on a daily basis and to get to know these people or what?
Yeah, I would go there. Boy, it was really random, but I would go, I'd say once a week or once every other week, something like that. I would end up going probably 15, 20 times, and on most occasions, one time I went and the weather turned real bad.
KKFI is proud to air the 21st annual homelessness marathon on Wednesday. There's a
vigorous hold on, Brandon. Okay. Go ahead.
Other times, I just didn't, you know, some people that I knew wouldn't be available. But most of the times I went there, I was able to at least get photographs and then also interviews with the people that I got to know. Most people I interview was just once, just to get their story and to get their perspective. But I did follow a couple of individuals, probably about four or five I followed throughout the fall. And closely I followed one couple, Earl and Kat, who she was in her 30s, he was in his 40s or even early 50s, and they had six kids between them that were all under the age of 10, and the kids were not present. So their hopes were to, of course, get out of the camp, get sober first, get out of the camp, and get their kids back, who were either with relatives or were in the foster care system. And Earl was actually my very first interview, August 15th of last year, and he would end up being my last interview December of last year, and in between many more interviews with him and his wife, Kat, at different stages of the seasons, both warm weather to fall to cooling off to cold winter. And so you get a really in-depth look at poverty, but also addiction, and what systems we have in place at a government level to help, and nonprofit level, and church level, community level, to help individuals who struggle.
All right. And in your movie, you featured a little bit the mayor of Minneapolis, and he said that housing is basically a basic right.
Mm-hmm.
Did the city council and as well as did mayors in the surrounding cities like St. Paul and Burnsville, did they back him up and support that idea?
I don't know of any cooperation with neighboring cities. Minneapolis, as far as I know, were prepared to take this situation on themselves. I don't think they reached out to other cities for help. I don't know of any cities that reached out to help. I do know they were greatly assisted, the city of Minneapolis was, by the red light Native American nation from northern Minnesota. They actually have, along with their, I don't know if it's a consulate or an embassy building in Minneapolis, they have some property. And on a plot of land that they owned across the highway from the camp, they agreed to help oversee. They didn't pay for the building of it, I don't believe. But it was on their land, and it was with their cooperation and assistance and oversight that some temporary shelters were built where most of the residents of the camp would go in December. So that was a big help because the city was having a tough time figuring out where they could build some temporary housing for these individuals. And if you watch the film, you see that they promise housing by the end of September. Well, they don't, I don't know if they necessarily say, I promise, but they say, we hope to have this for you all by the end of September. And then it gets pushed to mid-October, and then the end of October, and then later November, and finally on December 11th, I think, is the first day that some camp residents are able to move out. So that constant delay is the, you know, plays a part in the frustration of the residents, and that's clear in the film. But yeah, the city did work hard to not just provide the temporary housing, but work with nonprofits to try to provide apartments, like permanent housing, for those who were willing to either go to treatment or were simply willing to accept an offer of whatever the city or these nonprofits could, could provide.
Let me ask you, as far as the source of homelessness or cause of homelessness, seemed like in your film and from what I've read in terms of studies have been done, that some of the common threads are that a lot of the people come from broken homes when they were children, abusive relationships, and as a result, many of them have addiction issues. Is that fair to say? Is that where most of them develop homelessness out of? Or were there other things that were missing?
I had to be careful with this film and in my presentations. When I gave the three screenings, someone made sure to, you know, they challenged me on my assertions of the people staying at the wall because they thought I was giving a false impression of homelessness. And I made clear, and I'll make clear here, that, you know, this film isn't just about homelessness. It's about, or I should say, this film isn't about homelessness in general. This film is about the residents of this particular homeless camp. And so the statistics, and I did a little bit of research. I handed out surveys, and I found out roughly out of 100 survey participants, how many graduated, how many had jobs, how many had children under 18, how many were addicted. And I was told, and I believe, you know, this to be accurate, that I was told by the people who work in the homeless sector of the Twin Cities, that these aren't necessarily or even at all, I don't know what the general stats are, but they just wanted to make clear that these did not represent homeless statistics across the board. So when I speak of this particular camp, it is just of that particular camp, and I'll make that clear up front. But yes, of them, the 300 or so there, and the 100 for sure that I either surveyed or interviewed, yeah, broken homes, drugs, abuse, some sexual abuse when they were young, plenty of other kinds of abuse, verbal and physical, and just a lot of difficult upbringings and trauma that certainly made it difficult for them to establish themselves as adults, you know, who could hold work to avoid temptations of drug or alcohol abuse, to sustain relationships, and just in general to feel confident and good about themselves. That's really the number one thing I noticed from individuals there, and it's an unfortunate and very sad reality, but because we want a solution we can fix, especially fix with money. And it seemed the individuals there, even when offered the supplies necessary to, one, get by at the camp, and then, two, even afforded or offered an apartment, it didn't necessarily mean they either took, you know, it didn't necessarily mean that they wanted the apartment, and it certainly didn't mean that they were going to get sober. There was a dearth of, I think, self-confidence, self-worth, and I think that's the product of decades, maybe more, of challenging life on reservations or off the reservations in this particular community, the Native American community in Minnesota and probably across the country. I was encouraged at the same time because there were nonprofits within the community there to help at every turn, whether it was something to sustain them, whether, you know, food or clothing, or whether it was, you know, to encourage them that, you know, they can get work, they can finish that degree, they can get their kids back, that kind of thing. And that was really good to see.
But one of the people, when you talked to Kat, and she had contacted or was being helped some by a director from one of the shelters, and then she said that when she had a falling out with that director, she said they gave her the rope but no life jacket. Can you expand on what she was dealing with in terms of that comment?
She was, at that point in the movie, Kat had been putting off taking up the county or the city on a housing offer because she was holding out for something hopefully better from another nonprofit. And they had a falling out. That hope crashed down. And Kat, at that point in the film, which is about 3/4 of the way through, it's a new low because this is November, I believe, and she'd been waiting around since August. And now face the reality that the last 2 months have been, it's the last 2 months or so of waiting on this one opportunity was not going to pan out. And she felt like she wasted several weeks, hadn't yet seen her kids. As far as the relationship she had with that nonprofit leader, I don't know the details of it, other than what she described and what you heard in the film.
All right.
So I guess she felt sort of strung along by this nonprofit leader, that the nonprofit leader was making promises maybe she didn't keep, that she provided a lifeline, but she didn't provide a life jacket or however she put it in the film, so that the woman was, you know, here's some rope, you know, for you to hang on and come along. But when the rope was cut, there was no life preserver or something. She was trying to make an analogy, like, you know, when she cut me off after we had a falling out, now I'm here and I have nothing to float on, so I'm stuck and I'm going to sink here. At the same time, though, you have to take, I think, what Kat says with a grain of salt, because you just don't know the reality of these situations. There's always two sides to the story, and these are situations with people who are in difficult situations, who may be under the influence of hard drugs. And so I think the bottom line is Kat had her hopes up for the situation. It didn't work out. She'd been putting off an offer from the county, and so she felt wronged and hurt, dejected, and it was just another low point for her, and so it was difficult all around. And knowing that she wasn't going to be able to see her kids, you know, for another while longer, because, you know, who knows when there's going to be another opportunity to have an apartment.
Yeah, one of the statistics in your film was that 48% of the people living in this camp have children under the age of 18. So are the majority of those children, are they mostly placed in foster care, or are they living on the reservations with the tribes, or with families?
Well, there's a lot of overlap with that because of laws, where I believe it's still the case, although it's being debated presently, where when a Native American child is up for placement due to in the foster care system, preference will be given to other Native American couples. So they often stay on the reservation or another reservation where they're placed with foster parents. That said, I think many of them too, including Kat Narrows, are able to find homes with family. Families are very close. And that's something else I learned, is just how close the Native American community is. So close that people went down to the camp and stayed there, both to help and to live, even if they had other places to be, even if they had a home of their own. There's a real solidarity within the Native American community that was impressive, touching. It was a lot. I wasn't used to that. I certainly don't have that in my life. So if one couple aren't able to be there for their children, an aunt, a grandparent, commonly, I believe, will be able to help out. And if not, then, yeah, they get put in the foster care system where I believe most of them, if not all of them, are placed with other Native American families.
Some of your statistics looked at alcohol and drug use among the people in this camp. Did you get the feeling that most of them wanted to resolve their addiction problems, or did a lot of them just not care?
I don't think it's a matter of whether or not they cared and whether or not they wanted to. I think it comes down to how in touch they were with themselves. Like, we all want to be healthy, but how many of us are going to do the necessary things to be as healthy or be healthier? We all want to be healthy, but we also want to eat snacks, right? So I'm sure they all wanted to be sober deep down. If you got real with them, they did. It's just they weren't. didn't seem there was much opportunity or willingness, perhaps, to get that real. In the instance of those I interviewed, there was often you know, an excuse to not seek the treatment, even though they knew it was very close by. All they had to do was make the walk up the block and they could access services for treatment. But, you know, being at the camp was sort of a vacation from life for some of them. Earl sums that up in the very first line of the film. We don't want the responsibility, he said. And on the other side of that wall, there's all of our responsibility. We just like it here. So there was a protection, a buffer between them and the real world that the camp represented. And, you know, there's power in numbers, and that can be a good or not good thing. It depends where the power goes. And a lot of people lauded the numbers at the camp because it represented them coming together as a show of force and to say, hey, we're here, we're not going to be ignored. And there's truth to that. But at the same time, once a tipping point of people there are abusing, you start to drag down others who may not have used ordinarily, and then they begin to use and drink. And it became a daily, ordinary thing for people there to turn to chemicals for just part of their routine.
You mentioned before the lack of confidence among most of the people there, et cetera. And I was struck by a statement by one of the people you interviewed, and he said, one of the things that helps means a lot to them is just for people to come to their camp and visit and just give them a hug and tell them that they are worth something. And something that's very simple to do. Do you think people, when they see your film, are going to get that message and maybe do something like that?
I hope so. You know, that's the kind of message I want people to get. I think, you know, most of the film is the day-to-day, the histories of these individuals. And, you know, a significant percentage is comprised of these insights. Like this gentleman, Tony, is who you're referring to. He said just what you said. And a woman named Karen, who was a middle-aged woman, talked about mentoring younger women who are turning to prostitution. And she said regarding them that they never hear that they're good enough. And so she is there to tell them that. The phrase she uses in the film is, I know you will be the queen you are meant to be. And she tears up as she recalls telling them this, because she just feels the void of such, you know, the need for such encouragement.
Brandon, we are out of time. I'd like to have you on again later this fall to follow up on this. I think we just barely touched the tip of the iceberg. Before we cut you off, can you give us your website that you have if people want more information about this?
Certainly. Yeah, it's The Periphery. THEPERIPHERY. ThePeripHery.com. You can also Google my name, Brandon Fertig, FERDIG. My YouTube channel is called The Periphery, and I am open to screenings all over the country. I have one in Wisconsin next month. I have one in the Twin Cities. Actually, I have one in the Twin Cities next month. I have one in Wisconsin in September. And I will be hosting others, I'm sure, in the Twin Cities. I'd like to expand this to other communities, Kansas City and elsewhere, because I just think, one, it's rare to have a documentary get this in-depth with the people who are struggling with this epidemic.
Hey, Brandon, we do have to go. We're out of time. I want to thank you for joining us. Coming up next, we have a couple of calendar items followed by Counterspin.
Yes, I want to thank both Craig and his guest for a very entertaining show. Okay, yeah, a couple of next week on Radioactive Magazine, Pat Reilly was going to have Peaceworks on, talking about Peaceworks KC, about